evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. Is air travel safe in South Sudan?
Most common experience with these airlines, sometimes they have no seat belts, they have no windows. Sometimes they are part cargo such that exit routes are blocked, and sometimes they are without any flight attendant to guide the passengers.
And a prominent South Sudanese politician files suit against a woman in the diaspora for slander.
This has gone beyond to my person, to my honor, and it is that very grave. It is about me being threatened with assassination and being killed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A frequent traveler on South Sudanese registered airlines say there are serious air safety issues in South Sudan. Jock Madur Jock, who is a researcher for the SADIN Institute, says some airlines owned by South Sudanese, Kenyans and some Europeans pay little attention to the safety of passengers. South Spring Airlines hit a fire brigade truck while landing and crashed at Wau Airport, bursting into flames on Monday. A known number of passengers were injured in that incident. Jock says South Sudan aviation authorities should enforce strict international safety rules at all South Sudanese airports to avoid future accidents. He says the incident at Wau Airport should serve as a wake-up call.
The airlines going to Wau have had a very short lifespan because of mechanical problems of the kinds of air fleet that they possess. We've gone from something called Kush Airlines to Malik Airlines to Atlas Airlines, some of which operate for a couple of months at most, and then get grounded. Most common experience with these airlines are just very uncomfortable inside of the plane. Sometimes they have no seat belts, they have no windows. Sometimes they are part cargo such that exit routes are blocked, and sometimes they are without any flight attendants to guide the passengers whatsoever. This is the most common thing I have seen, and I have heard people complain about the fact that the plane itself is not fit for passengers. As a passenger plane.
What about air safety regulations? I mean, Juba Airport Authority is supposed to oversee the welfare of passengers on some of these planes.
South Sudan Civil Aviation Authority is there, and it is tasked to regulate aviation in line with International Civil Aviation Authority regulations. Aviation safety, aviation security, all of these things are set up in Juba International Airport, and yet you find that local domestic air operators don't seem to be subjected to some of these regulations. Otherwise, this incident in Wau yesterday has raised once again where citizens are asking the government what is going on. How are people's lives being wasted in such a manner in a place where there are regulations and there are authorities and yet are not enforced? Whose responsibility is it to ensure that people are safe?
Who owns these local airlines that you were mentioning them? Are these foreign-owned or are they owned by wealthy South Sudanese?
They are usually partly owned by South Sudanese nationals with some backing from financiers or from operators from Ukraine or Moldova or from East Africa. So it's usually a joint partnership. The one that went on fire in Wau is 100% owned by a local businessman.
When the question of safety arises, one would imagine that South Sudanese authorities should have been strict on some of these carriers.
Yes, as is known, all the international operators that serve South Sudan are scrutinized by their national authorities in Kigali, in Nairobi, in Addis Ababa, in Dubai, in Khartoum, and Cairo. These are some of the places where major airlines serve Juba from. But when it comes to local airlines, the authorities have definitely fallen much short of their responsibility to do the same with the local airlines and with the lives of South Sudanese. I think what has made it very difficult in the last few months, particularly, is the fact that these airlines do not have access to foreign currencies to send their airplanes for service in such places as I mentioned, which would be the required regulation that if you don't show certificate of safety regulations enforced, then you should not fly.
That's Jock Madud Jock, director of the Juba-based Sudan Institute. He was speaking with me yesterday from New York. The transitional government of national unity says rebels allied to former first vice president Riek Machar killed one policeman and abducted three oil workers Sunday in Faluj oil fields in the former Upper Nile state. President Salva Kiir ordered the deployment of additional security personnel to guard oil fields and protect workers. SPLA-IO military spokesman confirms his group abducted the oil workers, but says they did it because the profit from the oil sales goes straight into the pockets of certain individuals rather than benefiting South Sudanese people. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makwe says the four oil workers, including a Pakistani, were abducted at Gumri oil fields of northern Upper Nile State after rebels infiltrated the fields. Makwe says the rebels first abducted four men, but later killed the fourth, a policeman.
They intercepted four of them. One of them was a soldier, and the other three were one was a driver and the other two were technicians. It is in the southern part of the oil field. This is the intention of the rebels. They want to tell the people that they are capable of shutting down the oil field. As long as this is the second time, I think we will not allow the threat to happen.
Makwe says the oil workers and a policeman were abducted while the workers were checking on operations in the oil wells. It marks the second time this month that rebels have kidnapped oil workers from oil fields in this area. A week and a half ago, rebels abducted two Indian oil workers from the Adar oil fields in northern Upper Nile State. The two workers are still being held captive at an unknown location. Lieutenant Colonel Paul Lam Gabriel, the SPLA-IO deputy military spokesman, confirms SPLA-IO forces abducted the workers but defended the action.
We don't really encourage these oil workers to continue doing or drilling the oil because we know it is going always to private pocket and purchasing of ammunition instead of helping the citizens. So the soldiers decided to apprehend them and overtake them.
Yesterday, South Sudan Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lulgat-Kwoth and a team of senior military officials visited the oil fields in northern Upper Nile State to try to reassure oil workers that the Juba government will protect them. Gatkoth says he was ordered by President Salva Kiir to visit the oil fields and tell oil workers the government is taking measures to prevent similar abductions. Gatkoth tried to reassure oil workers in Paluj yesterday about their safety.
The president has instructed all the forces, the army, the national security, the police, to provide maximum security protection for all the workers. From today onward, this one is not going to happen again. We will make sure that even if it is one person going out for the normal operations in the field, they will be escorted.
Gatkoth appealed to both South Sudanese and foreign oil workers to cooperate with the government and continue their work. He says government is working to see that the abductees are released safely, but insists Juba will not negotiate with the abductors.
We are working to get them released unconditionally. We don't want to negotiate with terrorists, and we will not succumb to them demanding ransom like $1 million. We will not pay any. We will not pay a single penny to get them released. They must be released unconditionally.
South Sudan currently pumps at least 130,000 barrels of oil per day. That is down from about 180,000 barrels per day before the outbreak of fighting in December 2013 and 360,000 barrels a day before the oil shut down in January 2012. For VOA News, I am Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A South Sudanese politician and founder of the civil society group called South Sudan Reborn is suing a member of the diaspora. Pagana Mum says he is a victim of slander. He says he also is sending a strong message to perpetrators of hate speech, as we hear from Ayen Bior in Washington.
Pagana Mum says the slanderous comments were disseminated by a South Sudanese woman in the diaspora, who goes by the name of Amira Ali on a social website and lives in the same city as he does, Denver, Colorado. Amum says Ali, popularly known as Amira, has posted several videos on Facebook targeting him. Here is an excerpt of one of Amira's Facebook postings where she attacks various South Sudanese politicians. Ali, who is also identified as Amira Awad in court documents, not only calls Amum names, but accuses him of committing rape and murder, all of which Amum says are untrue. Amum says at the heart of his lawsuit against Ali is a demonization of tribes or regions and putting certain tribes against each other by posting lies on the internet.
The real context is what is very dangerous, and that is the use of social media platforms to generate hate speech, hatred, demonization of people or individuals on tribal grounds, demonizing tribes or regions, and inciting tribes to violence, inciting certain tribes to go kill other tribes. And this person in particular, but also a few others, are engaged in doing this.
Amum says he understands that public figures are subjected to criticism, but he says the accusations made against him go beyond criticism and are slanderous. But beyond the personal attacks against his reputation, Amum says the comments about him online have real consequences that threaten the chances of lasting peace and security in South Sudan. Amum also accuses Ali of making comments that threaten his well-being and the safety of his family, both here in the United States and abroad. He says Ali has also engaged in hate speech on social media about other South Sudanese political figures.
Just yesterday, she made a video abusing Thomas Cirillo for the political decision he has taken, and going beyond Thomas Cirillo and talking of this is the Bari who are rebelling, and now you rebel, and if we come to kill you as the Dinkas, then you come and complain. Imagine. This is really the problem.
Ali denies she has presented a threat to Amum or anyone else in the diaspora or back home by the posts she's made on Facebook.
Everybody have to find my record. I don't hurt somebody. I don't kill somebody. Why be scared about me? The Pagan, they want to kill us. The Pagan want to take the money for us. Me, the one I need the security for Pagan. It's not Pagani needs security for me.
Ali is due to make a court appearance in Denver on Tuesday. She says she is prepared to tell the judge she is protected under the law to exercise her right to free speech. She also claims to be a victim of hate speech online from people loyal to Amum. Ali says she tried to take out a restraining order against Amum and also tried to hire a lawyer, but that would have cost $15,000, money which she says she does not have. Ali says she will be in court next week.
I have the reason that all the sisters do the videos before me. And then I pay back. I have to defend myself. Pagan Pagan is my leader. He can't take me to the court. Why don't call community first? You have to call the community first. I sit down with Pagan. Pagan, he told me, Amira, this is wrong. I told him, Pagan, this is wrong. Then my community be fixed, you know? And right now, Pagan is dumb. He's a big leader. He has the money. He want to keep me quiet. can't be quiet for my country. I defend my people. I'm not be quiet.
Amoom says there is a difference between free speech and hate speech, and Ali has crossed that line. He says online mediums like Facebook have become platforms for hate speech.
This violation becomes a hate speech when the content of the person exercising this speech, it ceases to become a free speech and become a hate speech when the content is inciting violence, is demonizing and dehumanizing persons for whatever reasons that they aim, either they aim to destroy them or they want to justify committing crimes against them, or they want to discriminate against them, or they want to justify carrying out atrocities.
Although free speech is protected under the Constitution of the United States, there have been many lawsuits filed to try libel, slander, and defamation. Amoom says he hopes that the restraining order he has taken out against Ali will act as a warning to other South Sudanese who make slanderous remarks online. He says he wants to remind the diaspora that not only are there legal consequences, but slanderous words on social media sites have the potential to tear communities apart. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Tell me about something beautiful that moved you recently.
A cousin of mine gave birth after a long period of trying to have a baby. It took them about 6 years to have their first baby.
The most beautiful thing that moves me recently is the roads and also the lights and also the happiness of my family.
Oh yeah, I have a lot, but what I can say is education. I've just pursued my degree and it's really doing me well because I've already got a job that can earn me and then improve my life.
Something that moved me recently is that I was given a responsibility to head a big project, first of its kind in my life. So it's something that was great.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. A senior Catholic bishop from South Sudan met with Catholic Charity in Rome yesterday to discuss ways to deal with the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. Reporter Josephine McKinnon tells VOA's Kim Lewis that officials say there is mass starvation with almost 2 million people internally displaced and 1.5 million are refugees.
The Global Catholic Aid Network Caritas operates in 7 dioceses across South Sudan. The senior officials from the organization have come to Rome to talk about what they consider to be a looming humanitarian crisis. They're saying there is mass starvation. An estimated 1.8 million people have been displaced internally, and they estimate there are 1.5 million refugees there now. But a very serious situation where there is no food, there is a famine, and people are desperately seeking food and an emergency response to this situation. So these officials are meeting to discuss the crisis and look at ways of drawing international attention to what's going on as well.
Also, who were all of the people that they were meeting with?
Well, the Senior Bishop, Bishop Ercolano Tombe, is the president of Caritas South Sudan, and he had the talks among senior officials from South Sudan and others in Vatican City today. He says South Sudan is collapsing and is in a state of chaos. There's a lack of medication, malnourished children, food scarcity. And so these officials are meeting others in the Catholic Church to talk about strategies and ways of not only trying to build peace in South Sudan, but also step up international aid efforts as well. They've been encouraged by Pope Francis, who has spoken out about the crisis several times, and Pope Francis has also talked about the possibility of a visit to South Sudan, which would help to draw international attention to this crisis, but that has not been confirmed so far.
I understand they also spoke about the severe operational challenges that they have in really just trying to access the remote rural areas of South Sudan to get to people who really need help.
Yes, many of the people are being forced to flee their homes, and the bishops told me they are heading to the hills just to survive. Now, the bishops are very cautious about discussing the level of violence, but they are talking about the incidents of gender-based violence, rape, and beatings and deaths that are occurring there. Church compounds are harboring thousands of vulnerable people seeking refuge from violent attacks. The bishop himself has been declaring that he's ready to even risk traveling into remote areas to try and talk to rebel forces and discuss their grievances. But they're also concerned about what they call scorched-earth destruction, how people have been herded into their homes, which have been set on fire. Atrocities are continuing even after their death, and people are living in fear. So there are food shortages, partly due to poor rain in parts of the country, but also attacks on harvests and on crops that are in areas where people are still able to grow food.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. Today is World Water Day. Zimbabwe received above normal rains this year, but there is not much cause to celebrate on this day. In South Sudan, clean water is a privilege for few, as in most parts of South Sudan, only small percentage of Zimbabweans have access to clean water. Sebastian Mwofu speaks to UN agencies about their plans to change that.
For the first time in 2 years, Zimbabwe has received an above-normal amount of rain. But with that came an outbreak of typhoid in January, and last week, cholera claimed 2 lives. Program manager Good Life Mudzingwa works for Community Water Alliance, a civic organization that deals with issues of water governance in Zimbabwe. Mudzingwa says there is nothing to celebrate come World Water Day this Wednesday.
Basically, there is nothing to celebrate in terms of water. In terms of availability, there is nothing that we can say has been made. And it also relates to the fiscal commitment in terms of the budgetary provision by the government to realize that right. Our previous analysis has shown that 0.4% has been committed to water provision. So when we look at all those components, it's an expression that there's nothing in terms of realization of the human right to water.
The right to water has been in Zimbabwe's constitution since 2013. But for 36-year-old Chipoma Shinga, enjoying that right is still far away. 2 or 3 times a week, she says she's about 30 meters down the Mkuwisi River from a busy bridge in Harare. With infant daughter Esther on her back and 4-year-old son Emmanuel nearby, she's doing laundry using river water. Upstream, industrial and human waste flow into the river, which organizations like Community Water Alliance have been complaining about to authorities. She says residents have no taps, so they use the river. And for 7 to 8 years, the authorities have not talked about providing water. She says drinking water comes from an open well, but the community would rather get clean water from boreholes. She adds they want good living and access to clean water since it is the people's source of life. For Zimbabwean, water is also the cornerstone of the country's mainstay, agriculture. That is why the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says it is happy that Zimbabwe received above normal rainfall this year. Southern Africa FAO head Chimimba David Piri says he is happier than the previous 2 years celebrating World Water Day. 2 years of drought had led to the FAO to begin rehabilitating Zimbabwe's irrigation system with funding from the European Union and the Swiss government.
The history of Zimbabwe is very interesting. There are a number of irrigation schemes that were created, but most of these schemes have gone into ruin, either because of siltation over a long period of time, a lack of maintenance, or sometimes it's the irrigation equipment itself that needs to be changed or repaired. The aim of that is to make sure that even during the time when there's no adequate rainfall, farmers in the irrigation schemes can produce enough for their own consumption but also for sale. The other one, of course, is to ensure that productivity increases on those farms by having two or three crops in a year.
Piri said the rain Zimbabwe received would not stop the 13 million irrigation project. He says the UN agents aims to ensure Zimbabwe improves its livestock and crop production by ensuring that farmers have water throughout the year.
Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with a traditional Baka song from my village in Maridi. This one is about love and bullets. Don't ask me why. we have been listening to a traditional Baka song from my village, Maridi. As I say, this one is about bullets and love. Don't ask me why. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.